Life in the foretop well agreed with Billy Budd. There, when not actually engaged on the yards, yet higher aloft, the topmen, who as such had been picked out for youth and activity, constituted an aerial club, lounging at ease against the smaller stunsails rolled up into cushions, spinning yarns like the lazy gods, and frequently amused with what was going on in the busy world of the decks below. No wonder, then, that a young fellow of Billy's disposition was well content in such society. Giving no cause of offense to anybody, he was always alert at a call. So in the merchant service it had been with him. But now such punctiliousness in duty was shown that his topmates would sometimes good-naturedly laugh at him for it. This heightened alacrity had its cause, namely, the impression made upon him by the first formal gangway punishment he had ever witnessed, which befell the day following his impressment. It had been incurred by a little fellow, young, a novice, an after-guardsman absent from his assigned post when the ship was being put about, a dereliction resulting in a rather serious hitch to that maneuver, one demanding instantaneous promptitude in letting go and making fast. When Billy saw the culprit's naked back under the scourge, gridironed with red welts and worse, when he marked the dire expression in the liberated man's face, as with his woolen shirt flung over him by the executioner he rushed forward from the spot to bury himself in the crowd, Billy was horrified. He resolved that never through remissness would he make himself liable to such a visitation, or do or omit aught that might merit even verbal reproof. What then was his surprise and concern when ultimately he found himself getting into petty trouble occasionally about such matters as the stowage of his bag, or something amiss in his hammock, matters under the police oversight of the ship's corporals of the lower decks, and which brought down on him a vague threat from one of them. So heedful in all things as he was, how could this be? He could not understand it, and it more than vexed him. When he spoke to his young topmates about it, they were either lightly incredulous or found something comical in his unconcealed anxiety. "Is it your bag, Billy?" said one. "Well, sew yourself up in it, Billy boy, and then you'll be sure to know if anybody meddles with it." Now there was a veteran aboard who, because his years began to disqualify him from more active work, had been recently assigned duty as a mainmast man in his watch, looking to the gear belayed at the rail round about that great spar near the deck. At oft-times the foretopman had picked up some acquaintance with him, and now in his trouble it occurred to him that he might be the sort of person to go for wise counsel. He was an old Dansker, long anglicized in the service, of few words, many wrinkles, and some honorable scars. His wizened face, time-tinted and weather-stormed to the complexion of an antique parchment, was here and there peppered blue by the chance explosion of a gun-carriage in action. He was an Agamemnon man, some 2 years prior to the time of this story having served under Nelson, when but Sir Horatio, in that ship immortal in naval memory, and which, dismantled and in parts broken up to her bare ribs, is seen a grand skeleton in Hayden's etching. As one of a boarding party from the Agamemnon, he had received a cut, slantwise along one temple and cheek, leaving a long pale scar like a streak of dawn's light falling athwart the dark visage. It was on account of that scar, and the affair in which it was known that he had received it, as well as from his blue-peppered complexion, that the Dansker went among the Indomitable's crew by the name of Board Her in the Smoke. Now, the first time that his small weasel eyes happened to light on Billy Budd, a certain grim internal merriment set all his ancient wrinkles into antic play. Was it that his eccentric, unsentimental old sapience, primitive in its kind, saw, or thought it saw, something which in contrast with the warship's environment looked oddly incongruous in the handsome sailor? But after slyly studying him at intervals, the old Merlin's equivocal merriment was modified by now. For now, when the twain would meet, it would start in his face a quizzing sort of look. But it would be but momentary, and sometimes replaced by an expression of speculative query as to what might eventually befall a nature like that, dropped into a world not without some man-traps, and against whose subtleties simple courage, lacking experience and address, and without any touch of defensive ugliness, is of little avail, and where such innocence as man is capable of does yet in a moral emergency not always sharpen the faculties or enlighten the will. However it was that Dansker, in his ascetic way, rather took to Billy. Nor was this only because of a certain philosophic interest in such a character. There was another cause. While the old man's eccentricity, sometimes bordering on the Ursine, repelled the juniors, Billy, undeterred thereby, would make advances, never passing the old Agamemnon man without a salutation marked by that respect which is seldom lost on the aged, however crabbed at times, or whatever their station in life. There was a vein of dry humor, or what not, in the masked man, and whether in freak of patriarchal irony touching Billy's youth and athletic frame, or for some other and more recondite reason, from the first, in addressing him, he always substituted Baby for Billy. The Dansker, in fact, being the originator of the name by which the foretopman eventually became known aboard ship. Well, then, in his mysterious little difficulty going in quest of the wrinkled one, Billy found him off duty in a dog watch, ruminating by himself, seated on a shot box of the upper gun deck, now and then surveying with a somewhat cynical regard certain of the more swaggering promenaders there. Billy recounted his trouble, again wondering how it all happened. The salt seer attentively listened, accompanying the foretopman's recitals with queer twitchings of his wrinkles and problematical little sparkles of his small ferret eyes. Making an end of his story, the foretopman asked, "And now, Dansker, do tell me what you think of it." The old man, shoving up the front of his tarpaulin and deliberately rubbing the long, slant scar at the point where it entered the thin hair, laconically said, "Baby Bud, Jemmy Legs," meaning the master-at-arms, "is down on you." "Jemmy Legs!" ejaculated Billy, his welkin eyes expanding. "What for? Why, he calls me the sweet and pleasant young fellow, they tell me."
"Does he so?" grinned the grizzled one, and then said, "Aye, baby lad, a sweet voice," says Jemmy Legs.
"Oh, not always, but to me he has. I seldom pass him, but there comes a pleasant word."
"And that's because he's down upon you, baby bud."
Such reiteration, along with the manner of it, incomprehensible to a novice, disturbed Billy almost as much as the mystery for which he had sought explanation. Something less unpleasingly oracular he tried to extract, but the old sea shirin, thinking perhaps that for the nonce he had sufficiently instructed his young Achilles, pursed his lips, gathered all his wrinkles together, and would commit himself to nothing further. Years, and those experiences which befall certain shrewder men subordinated lifelong to the will of superiors, all this had developed in the Dansker the pithy, guarded cynicism that was his leading characteristic. The next day an incident served to confirm Billy Budd in his incredulity as to the Dansker's strange summing up of the case submitted. The ship, at noon going large before the wind, was rolling on her course, and he, below at dinner and engaged in some sportful talk with the members of his mess, chanced in a sudden lurch to spill the entire contents of his soup pan upon the new scrubbed deck. Claggart, the master-at-arms, official rattan in hand, happened to be passing along the battery in a bay of which the mess was lodged, and the greasy liquid streamed just across his path. Stepping over it, he was proceeding on his way without comment, since the matter was nothing to take notice of under the circumstances, when he happened to observe who it was that had done the spilling. His countenance changed. Pausing, he was about to ejaculate something hasty at the sailor, but checked himself, and pointing down to the streaming soup, playfully tapped him from behind with his rattan, saying in a low musical voice, peculiar to him at times, "Handsomely done, my lad. And handsome is handsome did it, too." And with that passed on. Not noted by Billy as not coming within his view was the involuntary smile, or rather grimace, that accompanied Claggart's equivocal words. Arrogantly he drew down the thin corners of his shapely mouth. But everybody taking his remark as meant for humorous, and at which, therefore, as coming from a superior, they were bound to laugh with counterfeited glee, acted accordingly. And Billy, tickled, it may be, by the allusion to his being the handsome sailor, merrily joined in. Then, addressing his messmates, exclaimed, "There now, who says that Jemmy Legs is down on me?"
"And who said he was, beauty?"
demanded one Donald, with some surprise, whereat the foretopman looked a little foolish, recalling that it was only one person, border in the smoke,
who had suggested what to him was the smoky idea that this pleasant master at arms was in any peculiar way hostile to him. Meantime, that functionary resuming his path must have momentarily worn some expression less guarded than that of the bitter smile, and, usurping the face from the heart, some distorting expression, perhaps, for a drummer boy heedlessly frolicking along from the opposite direction, and chancing to come into light collision with his person, was strangely disconcerted by his aspect. Nor was the impression lessened when the official, impulsively giving him a sharp cut with the rattan, vehemently exclaimed, "Look where you go!" What was the matter with the master-at-arms? And be the matter what it might, how could it have direct relation to Billy Budd, with whom, prior to the affair of the spilled soup, he had never come into any special contact, official or otherwise? What indeed could the trouble have to do with one so little inclined to give offense as the merchant ship's peacemaker, even him who in Claggett's own phrase was the sweet and pleasant young fellow? Yes, why should Jemmy Legs, to borrow the Dansker's expression, be down on the handsome sailor? But, at heart and not for nothing, as the late chance encounter may indicate to the discerning, down on him, secretly down on him, he assuredly was. Now, to invent something touching the more private career of Claggett, something involving Billy Budd, of which something the latter should be wholly ignorant, some romantic incident implying that Claggett's knowledge of the young blue jacket began at some period anterior to his catching sight of him on board the 74, all this not so difficult to do, might avail in a way more or less interesting to account for whatever enigma may appear to lurk in the case. But, in fact, there was nothing of the sort. And yet the cause, necessarily to be assumed as the sole one assignable, is in its very realism as much charged with that prime element of Radcliffean romance, the mysterious, as any that the ingenuity of the author of The Mysteries of Udolpho could devise. For what can more partake of the mysterious than an antipathy spontaneous and profound, such as is evoked in certain exceptional mortals by the mere aspect of some other mortal, however harmless he may be, if not called forth by that very harmlessness itself? Now there can exist no irritating juxtaposition of dissimilar personalities comparable to that which is possible aboard a great warship fully manned and at sea. There, every day, among all ranks, almost every man comes into more or less of contact with almost every other man, wholly there to avoid even the sight of an aggravating object. One must needs give it Jonah's toss, or jump overboard himself. Imagine how all this might eventually operate on some peculiar human creature the direct reverse of a saint. But for the adequate comprehending of Claggett by a normal nature, these hints are insufficient. To pass from a normal nature to him, one must cross the deadly space between, and this is best done by indirection. Long ago, an honest scholar, my senior, said to me, in reference to one who, like himself, is now no more, a man so unimpeachably respectable that against him nothing was ever openly said, though among the few something was whispered, "Yes, X is a nut not to be cracked by the tap of a lady's fan. You are aware that I am the adherent of no organized religion, much less of any philosophy built into a system. Well, for all that, I think that to try and get into X, enter his labyrinth, and get out again without a clue derived from some source other than what is known as knowledge of the world, that were hardly possible, at least for me." "Why?" said I. "X, however singular a study to some, is yet human, and knowledge of the world assuredly implies the knowledge of human nature and in most of its varieties." "Yes, but a superficial knowledge of it serving ordinary purposes. But for anything deeper, I am not certain whether to know the world and to know human nature be not two distinct branches of knowledge, which, while they may coexist in the same heart, yet either may exist with little or nothing of the other. Nay, in an average man of the world, his constant rubbing with it blunts that fine spiritual insight indispensable to the understanding of the essential in certain exceptional characters, whether evil ones or good. In a matter of some importance, I have seen a girl wind an old lawyer about her little finger. Nor was it dotage of senile love, nothing of the sort. But he knew law better than he knew the girl's heart. Coke and Blackstone hardly shed so much light into obscure spiritual places as the Hebrew prophets. And who were they? Mostly recluses. At the time, my inexperience was such that I did not quite see the drift of all this. It may be that I see it now. And indeed, if that lexicon, which is based on Holy Writ, were any longer popular, one might with less difficulty define and denominate certain phenomenal men. As it is, one must turn to some authority not liable to the charge of being tinctured with the biblical element. In a list of definitions included in the authentic translation of Plato, a list is attributed to him, occurs this: natural depravity, a depravity according to nature. A definition which, though savoring of Calvinism, by no means involves Calvin's dogma as to total mankind. Evidently, its intent makes it applicable but to individuals. Not many are the examples of this depravity which the gallows and jails apply. At any rate, for notable instances, since these have no vulgar alloy of the brute in them, but invariably are dominated by intellectuality, one must go elsewhere. Civilization, especially if of the austerer sort, is auspicious to it. It folds itself in the mantle of respectability. It has its certain negative virtues serving as silent auxiliaries. It is not going too far to say that it is without vices or small sins. There is a phenomenal pride in it that excludes them from anything, never mercenary or avaricious. In short, the depravity here meant partakes nothing of the sordid or sensual. It is serious, but free from acerbity. Though no flatterer of mankind, it never speaks ill of it. But the thing which in eminent instances signalizes so exceptional a nature is this. Though the man's even temper and discreet bearing would seem to intimate a mind peculiarly subject to the law of reason, not the less in his soul's recesses he would seem to riot in complete exemption from that law, having apparently little to do with reason further than to employ it as an ambidexter implement for effecting the irrational. That is to say, toward the accomplishment of an aim which his wantonness of malignity would seem to partake of the insane, he will direct a cool judgment, sagacious and sound. These men are true madmen, and of the most dangerous sort, for their lunacy is not continuous, but occasional, evoked by some special object. It is secretive and self-contained, so that when most active, it is to the average mind not distinguished from sanity. And, for the reason above suggested, that whatever its aim may be, and the aim is never disclosed, the method and the outward proceeding is always perfectly rational. Now something such was Claggart, in whom was the mania of an evil nature not engendered by vicious training or corrupting books or licentious living, but born with him and innate, in short, a depravity according to nature. Can it be this phenomenon, disowned or not acknowledged, that in some criminal cases puzzles the courts? For this cause have our juries at times not only to endure the prolonged contentions of lawyers with their fees, but also the yet more perplexing strife of the medical experts with theirs. But why leave it to them? Why not subpoena as well the clerical proficients, their vocation bringing them into peculiar contact with so many human beings, and sometimes in their least guarded hour, in interviews very much more confidential than those of physician and patient? This would seem to qualify them to know something about those intricacies involved in the question of moral responsibility, whether in a given case, say, the crime proceeded from mania in the brain or rabies of the heart. As to any differences among themselves these clerical proficients might develop on the stand, these could hardly be greater than the direct contradictions exchanged between the remunerated medical experts. Dark sayings are these, some will say. But why? It is because they somewhat savor of Holy Writ in its phrase, mysteries of iniquity. The point of the story, turning on the hidden nature of the master at arms, has necessitated this chapter.
With an added hint or two in connection with the accident of the mess, the resumed narrative must be left to vindicate, as it may, its own credibility. Pale ire, envy, and despair. That Claggart's figure was not amiss, and his face, save the chin, well molded, has already been said. Of these favorable points he seemed not insensible, for he was not only neat but careful in his dress. But the form of Billy Budd was heroic, and if his face was without the intellectual look of the pallid Claggart's, not the less was it lit, like his, from within, though from a different source. The bonfire in his heart made luminous the rose tan in his cheek. In view of the marked contrast between the persons of the twain, it is more than probable that when the master-at-arms in the scene last given applied to the sailor the proverb, "Handsome is as handsome does," he there let escape an ironic inkling, not caught by the young sailors who heard it, as to what it was that had first moved him against Billy, namely his significant personal beauty. Now envy and antipathy, passions irreconcilable in reason, nevertheless in fact may spring conjoined, like Chang and Eng, in one birth. Is envy, then, such a monster? Well, though many an arraigned mortal has, in hopes of mitigated penalty, pleaded guilty to horrible actions, did ever anybody seriously confess to envy? Something there is in it universally felt to be more shameful than even felonious crime. And not only does everybody disown it, but the better sort are inclined to incredulity when it is in earnest imputed to an intelligent man. But since its lodgment is in the heart, not the brain, no degree of intellect supplies a guarantee against it. But Claggart's was no vulgar form of the passion, nor, as directed toward Billy Budd, did it partake of that streak of apprehensive jealousy that marred Saul's visage perturbedly brooding on the comely young David. Claggart's envy struck deeper. If askance he eyed the good looks, cheery health, and frank enjoyment of young life in Billy Budd, it was because these happened to go along with a nature that, as Claggart magnetically felt, had in its simplicity never willed malice, or experienced the reactionary bite of that serpent. To him the spirit lodged within Billy, and looking out from his welkin eyes, as from windows, that ineffability which made the dimple in his dyed cheek, supplied his joints and danced in his yellow curls, made him preeminently the handsome sailor. One person excepted, the master-at-arms was perhaps the only man in the ship intellectually capable of adequately appreciating the moral phenomenon presented, which, assuming various secret forms within him, at times in Billy Budd, and the insight but intensified his passion, assumed that of cynic disdain, disdain of innocence. To be nothing more than innocent. Yet in an aesthetic way he saw the charm of it, the courageous, free and easy temper of it, and fain would have shared it, but he despaired of it. With no power to annul the elemental evil in himself, though he could hide it readily enough, apprehending the good but powerless to be it, what recourse is left to a nature like Claggart's, surcharged with energy, as such natures almost invariably are, but to recoil upon itself, and like the scorpion for which the Creator alone is responsible, act out to the end its allotted part? Passion, and passion in its profoundest, is not a thing demanding a palatial stage whereon to play its part. Down among the groundlings, among the beggars and rakers of the garbage, profound passion is enacted, and the circumstances that provoke it, however trivial or mean, are no measure of its power. In the present instance, the stage is a scrubbed gun-deck, and one of the external provocations, a man-of-war's man's spilled soup. Now when the master-at-arms noticed whence came that greasy fluid streaming before his feet, he must have taken it, to some extent willfully perhaps, not for the mere accident it assuredly was, but for the sly escape of a spontaneous feeling on Billy's part, more or less answering to the antipathy on his own.
In effect, a foolish demonstration, he must have thought, and very harmless, like the futile kick of a heifer, which yet, were the heifer a shod stallion, would not be so harmless.
Even so was it that into the gall of envy Claggart infused the vitriol of his contempt. But the incident confirmed to him certain tell-tale reports purveyed to his ear by Squeak, one of his more cunning corporals, a grizzled little man, so nicknamed by the sailors on account of his squeaky voice and sharp visage ferreting about the dark corners of the lower decks after interlopers, satirically suggesting to them the idea of a rat in a cellar. Now his chiefs employing him as an implicit tool in laying little traps for the worriment of the foretopmen, for it was from the master-at-arms that the petty persecutions heretofore adverted to had proceeded, the corporal, having naturally enough concluded that his master could have no love for the sailor, made it his business, faithful under-strapper that he was, to ferment the ill blood by perverting to his chief certain innocent frolics of the good-natured foretopman, besides inventing for his mouth sundry contumelious epithets he claimed to have overheard him let fall. The master-at-arms never suspected the veracity of these reports, more especially as to the epithets, for he well knew how secretly unpopular may become a master-at-arms, at least a master-at-arms in those days zealous in his function, and how the blue-jackets shoot at him in private their raillery and wit, the nickname by which he goes among them, Jemmy Legs, implying under the form of merriment their cherished disrespect and dislike. In view of the greediness of hate for provocation, it hardly needed a purveyor to feed Claggart's passion. An uncommon prudence is habitual with the subtler depravity, for it has everything to hide, and in case of any merely suspected injury, its secretiveness voluntarily cuts it off from enlightenment or disillusion, and, not unreluctantly, action is taken, upon surmise as upon certainty. And the retaliation is apt to be in monstrous disproportion to the supposed offence. For when in anybody was revenge in its exactions aught else but an inordinate usurer? But how with Claggart's conscience? For though consciences are unlike as foreheads, every intelligence, not excluding the scriptural devils who believe and tremble, has one. But Claggart's conscience, being but the lawyer to his will, made ogres of trifles, probably arguing that the motive imputed to Billy in spilling the soup just when he did, together with the epithets alleged, these, if nothing more, made a strong case against him, nay, justified animosity into a sort of retributive righteousness. The Pharisee is the Guy Fawkes, prowling in the hid chambers, underlying some natures like Claggart's, and they can really form no conception of an unreciprocated malice. Probably the master-at-arms' clandestine persecution of Billy was started to try the temper of the man, but it had not developed any quality in him that enmity could make official use of, or ever pervert into even plausible self-justification, so that the occurrence at the mess, petty if it were, was a welcome one to that peculiar conscience assigned to be the private mentor of Claggart, and for the rest, not improbably, it put him upon new experiments. Not many days after the last incident narrated, something befell Billy Budd that more graveled him than aught that had previously occurred. It was a warm night for the latitude, and the foretopman, whose watch at the time was properly below, was dozing on the uppermost deck, whither he had ascended from his hot hammock, one of hundreds suspended so closely wedged together over a lower gun deck that there was little or no swing to them. He lay as in the shadow of a hillside, stretched under the lee of the booms, a piled ridge of spare spars, and among which the ship's largest boat, the launch, was stowed. Alongside of three other slumberers from below, he lay near one end of the booms which approached from the foremast, his station aloft on duty as foretopman being just over the deck station of the forecastleman, entitling him, according to usage, to make himself more or less at home in that neighborhood. Presently, he was stirred into semi-consciousness by somebody who must have previously sounded the sleep of the others, touching his shoulder, and then, as the foretopman raised his head, breathing into his ear in a quick whisper, "Slip into the lee forechains, Billy. There is something in the wind. Don't speak. Quick, I will meet you there."
and who then disappeared. Now, Billy, like sundry other essentially good-natured ones, had some of the weaknesses inseparable from essential good nature, and among these was a reluctance, almost an incapacity, of plumply saying no to an abrupt proposition not obviously absurd on the face of it, nor obviously unfriendly, nor iniquitous. And being of warm blood, he had not the phlegm to negate any proposition or unresponsive inaction. Like his sense of fear, his apprehension as to aught outside of the honest and natural was seldom very quick. Besides, upon the present occasion, the drowse from his sleep still hung upon him. However it was, he mechanically rose, and sleepily wondering what could be in the wind, betook himself to the designated place, a narrow platform, one of six, outside of the high bulwarks, and screened by the great dead-eyes and multiple columned lanyards of the shrouds and backstays, and, in a great warship of that time, of dimensions commensurate to the ample hull's magnitude, a tarry balcony, in short, overhanging the sea, and so secluded that one mariner of the indomitable and nonconformist old tar of a serious turn made it even in daytime his private oratory. In this retired nook, the stranger soon joined Billy Budd. There was no moon as yet. A haze obscured the starlight. He could not distinctly see the stranger's face. Yet from something in the outline and carriage, Billy took him to be, and correctly, one of the afterguard.
"Hist, Billy!" said the man in the same quick cautionary whisper as before. "You were impressed, weren't you? Well, so was I."
And he paused as to mark the effect. But Billy, not knowing exactly what to make of this, said nothing. Then the other,
"We are not the only impressed ones, Billy. There's a gang of us. Couldn't you help at a pinch?"
"What do you mean?" demanded Billy, here shaking off his drowse.
"Hist, hist,"
the hurried whisper now growing husky.
"See here."
And the man held up two small objects, faintly twinkling in the nightlight.
"See, they are yours, Billy, if you'll only—"
But Billy broke in, and in his resentful eagerness to deliver himself, his vocal infirmity somewhat intruded.
"Damn, I don't know what you're driving at or what you mean, but you had better go where you belong."
For the moment the fellow, as confounded, did not stir, and Billy, springing to his feet, said,
"If you don't start, I'll toss you back over the rail."
There was no mistaking this, and the mysterious emissary decamped, disappearing in the direction of the mainmast in the shadow of the booms.
"Hello, what's the matter?"
here came growling from a forecastleman, awakened from his deck doze by Billy's raised voice. And as the foretopman reappeared and was recognized by him,
"Ah, beauty, is it you? Well, something must have been the matter, for you stuttered.
"Oh," rejoined Billy, now mastering the impediment, "I found an afterguardsman in our part of the ship here, and I bid him be off where he belongs."
"And is that all you did about it, foretopman?"
gruffly demanded another, an irascible old fellow of brick-colored visage and hair, and who was known to his associate forecastleman as Red Pepper.
"Such sneaks I should like to marry to the gunner's daughter."
By that expression meaning that he would like to subject them to disciplinary castigation over a gun. However, Billy's rendering of the matter satisfactorily accounted to these inquirers for the brief commotion, since of all the sections of a ship's company, the forecastlemen, veterans for the most part, and bigoted in their sea prejudices, are the most jealous in resenting territorial encroachments, especially on the part of any of the afterguard, of whom they have but sorry opinion, chiefly landsmen never going aloft, except to reef or furl the mainsail, and in no wise competent to handle a marling spike or turn in a dead-eye, say. This incident sorely puzzled Billy Budd. It was an entirely new experience, the first time in his life that he had ever been personally approached in underhand, intriguing fashion. Prior to this encounter, he had known nothing of the afterguardsmen, the two men being stationed wide apart, one forward and aloft during his watch, the other on deck and aft. What could it mean? And could they really be guineas, those two glittering objects the interloper had held up to his, Billy's, eyes? Where could the fellow get guineas? Why, even buttons, spare buttons, are not so plentiful at sea. The more he turned the matter over, the more he was nonplussed, and made uneasy and discomforted. in disgustful recoil from an overture which, though he but ill comprehended, he instinctively knew must involve evil of some sort, Billy Budd was like a young horse fresh from the pasture, suddenly inhaling a vile whiff from some chemical factory, and by repeated snortings trying to get it out of his nostrils and lungs. This frame of mind barred all desire of holding further parley with the fellow, even were it but for the purpose of gaining some enlightenment as to his design in approaching him. And yet he was not without natural curiosity to see how such a visitor in the dark would look in broad day. He espied him the following afternoon in his first dog watch below, one of the smokers on that forward part of the upper gun deck allotted to the pipe. He recognized him by his general cut and build, more than by his round, freckled face and glassy eyes of pale blue, veiled with lashes all but white. And yet Billy was a bit uncertain whether indeed it were he, yonder chap about his own age, chatting and laughing in free-hearted way, leaning against a gun, a genial young fellow enough to look at, and something of a rattle-brain to all appearance, rather chubby, too, for a sailor, even an after-guardsman. In short, the last man in the world, one would think, to be overburdened with thoughts, especially those perilous thoughts that must needs belong to a conspirator in any serious project, or even to the underling of such a conspirator. Although Billy was not aware of it, the fellow, with a sidelong watchful glance, had perceived Billy first, and then, noting that Billy was looking at him, thereupon nodded a familiar sort of friendly recognition as to an old acquaintance, without interrupting the talk he was engaged in with the group of smokers. A day or two afterwards, chancing in the evening promenade on a gun deck to pass Billy, he offered a flying word of good fellowship, as it were, which by its unexpectedness and equivocalness under the circumstances so embarrassed Billy that he knew not how to respond to it and let it go unnoticed. Billy was now left more at a loss than before. The ineffectual speculations into which he was led were so disturbingly alien to him that he did his best to smother them. It never entered his mind that here was a matter which, from its extreme questionableness, it was his duty as a loyal bluejacket to report in the proper quarter, and probably, had such a step been suggested to him, he would have been deterred from taking it by the thought, one of novice magnanimity, that it would savor over much of the dirty work of a telltale. He kept the thing to himself. Yet upon one occasion he could not forbear a little disburdening himself to the old Dansker, tempted thereto perhaps by the influence of a balmy night when the ship lay becalmed, the twain, silent for the most part, sitting together on deck, their heads propped against the bulwarks. But it was only a partial and anonymous account that Billy gave, the unfounded scruples above referred to preventing full disclosure to anybody. Upon hearing Billy's version, the sage Dansker seemed to divine more than he was told, and after a little meditation, during which his wrinkles were pursed, as into a point, quite effacing for the time that quizzing expression his face sometimes wore, "Didn't I say so, baby Bud?" "Say what?" demanded Billy. "Why, Jemmy Legs is down on you." "And what," rejoined Billy in amazement, "has Jemmy Legs to do with that cracked after-guardsman?" "Oh, it was an after-guardsman, then. A cat's paw, a cat's paw." And with that exclamation, which, whether it had reference to a light puff of air just then coming over the calm sea, or subtler relation to the after-guardsman, there is no telling. The old Merlin gave a twisting wrench with his black teeth at his plug of tobacco, vouchsafing no reply to Billy's impetuous question. For it was his wont to relapse into grim silence when interrogated in skeptical sort as to any of his sententious oracles, not always very clear ones, rather partaking of that obscurity which invests most Delphic deliverances from any quarter. Long experience had very likely brought this old man to that bitter prudence which never interferes in aught and never gives advice. Yet, despite the Dansker's pithy insistence as to the master at arms being at the bottom of these strange experiences of Billy on board the Indomitable, the young sailor was ready to ascribe them to almost anybody but the man who, to use Billy's own expression, had always had a pleasant word for him. This is to be wondered at, yet not so much to be wondered at. In certain matters some sailors, even in mature life, remain unsophisticated enough, but a young seafarer of the disposition of our athletic foretopman is much of a child man. And yet a child's utter innocence is but its blank ignorance, and the innocence more or less wanes as intelligence waxes. But in Billy Budd, intelligence, such as it was, had advanced, while his yet simple-mindedness remained for the most part unaffected. Experience is a teacher indeed, yet did Billy's years make his experience small. Besides, he had none of that intuitive knowledge of the bad which in natures not good or incompletely so foreruns experience, and therefore may pertain, as in some instances it too clearly does pertain, even to youth. And what could Billy know of man, except of man as a mere sailor? And the old-fashioned sailor, the veritable man before the mast, the sailor from boyhood up, he, though indeed of the same species as a landsman, is in some respects singularly distinct from him. The sailor is frankness, the landsman is finesse. Life is not a game with the sailor demanding the long head, no intricate game of chess where few moves are made in straightforwardness, but ends are attained by indirection, an oblique, tedious, barren game, hardly worth that poor candle burnt out in playing it. Yes, as a class, sailors are in character a juvenile race. Even their deviations are marked by juvenility, and this more especially held true with the sailors of Billy's time. Then, too, certain things which apply to all sailors do more pointedly operate here and there upon the junior one. Every sailor, too, is accustomed to obey orders without debating them. His life afloat is externally ruled for him. He is not brought into that promiscuous commerce with mankind where unobstructed free agency on equal terms, equal superficially at least, soon teaches one that unless upon occasion he exercises a distrust keen in proportion to the fairness of the appearance, some foul turn may be served him. A ruled, undemonstrative distrustfulness is so habitual, not with businessmen so much as with men who know their kind in less shallow relations than business, namely certain men of the world, that they come at last to employ it, all but unconsciously, and some of them would very likely feel real surprise at being charged with it as one of their general characteristics. But after the little matter at the mess, Billy Budd no more found himself in strange trouble at times about his hammock or his clothes-bag or what not. While, as to that smile that occasionally sunned him and the pleasant passing word, these were, if not more frequent, yet of anything more pronounced than before. But for all that, there were certain other demonstrations now. When Claggett's unobserved glance happened to light on belted Billy rolling along the upper gun-deck in the leisure of the second dog-watch, exchanging passing broadsides of fun with other young promenaders in the crowd, that glance would follow the cheerful sea Hyperion with a settled meditative and melancholy expression, his eyes strangely suffused with incipient feverish tears. Then would Claggett look like the man of sorrows. Yes, and sometimes the melancholy expression would have in it a touch of soft yearning, as if Claggett could even have loved Billy but for fate and ban. But this was an evanescence, and quickly repented of, as it were, by an immitigable look, pinching and shriveling the visage into the momentary semblance of a wrinkled walnut. But sometimes, catching sight in advance of the foretopman coming in his direction, he would, upon their nearing, step aside a little to let him pass, dwelling upon Billy for the moment with the glittering dental satire of a guise. But upon any abrupt, unforeseen encounter, a red light would flash forth from his eye, like a spark from an anvil in a dusk smithy. That quick, fierce light was a strange one, darted from orbs which in repose were of a color nearest approaching a deeper violet, the softest of shades. Though some of these caprices of the pit could not but be observed by their object, yet were they beyond the construing of such a nature. And the thews of Billy were hardly comparable with that sort of sensitive spiritual organization which in some cases instinctively conveys to ignorant innocence an admonition of the proximity of the malign. He thought the master-at-arms acted in a manner rather queer at times, that was all. But the occasional frank air and pleasant word went for what they purported to be, the young sailor never having heard as yet of the too fair-spoken man. Had the foretopman been conscious of having done or said anything to provoke the ill will of the official, it would have been different with him, and his sight might have been purged, if not sharpened.
So was it with him in yet another matter. Two minor officers, the armorer and captain of the hold, with whom he had never exchanged a word, his position on the ship not bringing him into contact with them, these men now, for the first time, began to cast upon Billy, when they chanced to encounter him, that peculiar glance which evidences that the man from whom it comes has been some way tampered with, and to the prejudice of him upon whom the glance lights. Never did it occur to Billy as a thing to be noted, or a thing suspicious, though he well knew the fact that the armorer and captain of the hold, with the ship's yeoman, apothecary, and others of that grade, were by naval usage messmates of the master-at-arms, men with ears convenient to his confidential tongue. Our handsome sailor's manly forwardness upon occasion, and irresistible good nature, indicating no mental superiority tending to excite an invidious feeling, bred general popularity. And this goodwill, on the part of most of his shipmates, made him the less to concern himself about such mute aspects toward him as those whereto allusion has just been made. As to the after guardsman, though Billy, for reasons already given necessarily, saw little of him, yet when the two did happen to meet, invariably came the fellow's offhand cheerful recognition, sometimes accompanied by a passing pleasant word or two. Whatever that equivocal young person's original design may really have been, or the design of which he might have been the deputy, certain it was from his manner upon these occasions that he had wholly dropped it. It was as if his precocity of crookedness, and every vulgar villain is precocious, had for once deceived him, and the man he had sought to entrap as a simpleton had, through his very simplicity, baffled him. But shrewd ones may opine that it was hardly possible for Billy to refrain from going up to the after-guardsman and bluntly demanding to know his purpose in the initial interview so abruptly closed in the forechains. Shrewd ones may also think it but natural in Billy to set about sounding some of the other impressed men of the ship in order to discover what basis, if any, there was for the emissary's obscure suggestions as to plotting disaffection aboard. Yes, the shrewd may so think. But something more, or rather something else than mere shrewdness, is perhaps needful for the due understanding of such a character as Billy Budd's. As to Claggart, the monomania in the man, if that indeed it were, as involuntary disclosed by starts in the manifestations detailed, yet in general covered over by his self-contained and rational demeanor, this, like a subterranean fire, was eating its way deeper and deeper in him. Something decisive must come of it.